And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey! Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's my favorite time of the week.
Ugh, me too. After work. No, I'm kidding. Tuesdays.
I love to just sit and record, and I don't know if you guys know this, if you guys are new here, but Abby and I do not know what the other's case is, so like I get giddy getting to tell her something. I might give her a heads up, like today I told her, like, hey, if you're in a good mood, you won't be, because we're talking about the death of a child. Like, you know, you come into it with a headspace of like, this is where we're going to go, so like be ready for that, you know?
Right.
Because I figure like our listeners get that heads up from a description or an episode title that like I'm not going to let you go into it so blindly, and that's kind of how we operate. So just so you know, the other really doesn't know what we're talking about, but we kind of have like a gist of like, here's the overarching, like, okay, this might be a survivor story. Right. Like, last week, I knew it was an exoneration. I didn't know anything else. Yeah. I did not know we were getting into Stinky Cooch.
Oh, Stinky Cooch.
That caught me all by surprise.
That was so, I'll tell you what, it's true. We get so excited to tell the other one because it's like you get that genuine reaction. And honestly, like, podcasting is a little weird, right? Because it's just us in your kitchen, but yet all of you are around the table with us. But unlike any other kind of media where you're performing for someone, sort of, like, quote unquote, you get a reaction and you can read how it's going based off of the audience. So when we get to tell it to each other, I'm like, ha, that was good writing, just like I'd hoped.
And I don't know if you guys can tell, but so little of what we do is scripted. Like, I'd argue that none of it is. Like, we do our research and we have, like, our bullet points and we want to make sure that the facts of the case that we're accurately depicting those, like we're not making any of that up, but like the way that we interact with each other, like none of that shit's written down. That's just us. So you get what you get. It's the culmination of the day we've had, the week we've had, the case that we're talking about. So it's just like the table just keeps getting bigger and bigger with all of us sitting at it. And it's just, it's awesome.
Yes. And it's just so much fun. And it's nice to have like a little community of our little ATFTC fam of people that are into that sort of very laid back, authentic, chill, best friends chatting, but also like well-researched, well-educated true crime stories of what has happened to someone and how it's impacted their life. So
we've gotten so many messages that are like, I can tell you guys are best friends and I feel like the three of us are best friends and we're all just hanging out and I'm just like listening to you guys on speakerphone.
Yes.
And that is one of the biggest compliments. And I think that's my favorite kind of podcast to listen to. And I think that that's Abby's too. And it's not that that's our favorite kind of podcast because that's the kind of podcast we have. It's that we love that so much and that's what we've wanted to create too. So it's like
we get to add to it.
Yes, exactly. Like we value that. I like it relaxed. It can't be this dramatic retelling for me or I'll either like yawn or like almost laugh at the ridiculousness of it, but I also can't have it like dry and emotionless either.
Yes.
And I need some kind of interaction. And so like it kind of has to hit all of these spots just right. Like I need to cry a little. I need to laugh a little bit. I need to feel something. And I don't want to end it with like, yep, that sucked. Anyway, bye.
See you never. Yeah. And it's one of those things where I think when you hit that mark, you do it well. But when you don't, like when you're off a little bit or if somebody doesn't really understand, I'm going to say like the assignment, but if somebody doesn't understand all of the marks you're trying to hit and they need something else, they might take it a little bit differently. So we're hanging, we're chilling, we're giggling, but we are also very serious and very passionate about these things. So we sort of have this range within an episode where we might be hanging, chilling, goofing, laughing, and then, oh my gosh, this is so serious, I'm so sad, what can we do about this? Back to sort of the laughing, crying, all of it.
Yeah, I can't feel any one of those things too long, so it needs to keep it moving.
Right, and I like to bring it up only because I am so grateful for all of you who absolutely understand what we're doing and you're here for it, and hey, boo, we know. But also because if you are new here and you haven't heard our stuff before, we never wanted to come across like we are flippant or laughing at what's happening. It's just us interacting and trying to get through some of the most traumatic stories that have happened to people that you can possibly talk about.
Exactly. And I also, I love that you guys interact with us so much on Instagram. Oh my gosh,
I love it.
Our Q&As, we had a lot of fun with that. And of course, in true Allie fashion, because it was authentic and genuine and raw, we didn't look at the questions ahead of time. We just picked a couple random ones and yes. did them. And so off the cuff, I said the wrong show when Aww. We were talking about the true crime ones. And I think I said killer kids, and what I meant was killer cases. Because afterwards, I was like, that doesn't sound right. So then, of course, I went on Hulu. I was like, God damn it. And I think that was like from 2006 or something, like killer Got kids it. Was. Which I might have watched at one point, but the show that I had watched every single episode of was Killer Cases. That's and that's so the one funny. I really liked. So if you want something to binge and watch, I would recommend that if you haven't seen it. I also watched, I think, Jailbirds, which might have been on Netflix. I like the documentary style.
Yeah. Same.
True crime stuff. So if you have any recommendations, please let me know. But of course, I have to have a corrections corner within the first Q&A fun thing that we did. So leave it to me. Hey, this is Allie. Don't blame Abby for that.
Yeah, you can blame me for the rest of the shit.
Abby's the dad jokes. I'm apparently everything else.
You do our Instagram. You do everything for us. So yeah. but that's a good thing.
Well, what I do have for you today is a different kind of case. Because obviously we're going to talk about a case, but what we had done more in the past, and we got some messages from some listeners about wanting to bring more of those back, are sort of our CJ shorts or some of Yes. our criminal justice special topics where we talk more about the criminal justice system in the context of a case as well. And so that's what I'm giving you today. See, when you ask for it, you shall receive it. You guys wanted exoneration, you got exoneration. You wanted Bling. This, you'll get this. Bling. See? So for our skippers, stop skipping.
Yoo-hoo, pods on.
That'd be a sticker, pods on.
Cute.
But hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. Aww. About time for true crime.
I'm blushing.
For all of you that skipped, but I do know that our number of listeners just continues to grow and grow. And I want to tell you again just how grateful we are for each and every one of you. We work so very hard on our little corner of the true crime world, and just to make it a place where we can speak freely, learn a lot, express ourselves, laugh so we don't cry, feel all the things. And we strongly believe that that table is big enough for all of us.
Absolutely.
Abby and I are just two women in the field who work in criminal justice, who have a combined decade of education in the field, and who choose to then spend countless hours outside of both of those things to continue talking about true crime. So we're nerds, if you couldn't tell.
May I offer you my special interest?
Yes. Our hyperfixation, if you will.
Oh, we would.
Today, I have to warn you, it's an especially difficult case. They all are. This one is especially, but like all of them, it's still an important one to talk about. And the discussions around this case and others like it should be ongoing, and for many reasons that we'll talk about toward the end. So I want to get into it because Ooh. We do have a lot to talk about relating to the case and all of the discussions around the case.
Okay.
Today we're talking about the kidnapping, rape, and murder
Ugh.
Of 7-year-old Megan Kanka.
Oh my gosh, you weren't kidding.
Just so you know from the top, so you are going into this.
Ugh.
You know how bad it's going to get.
Okay.
And if this isn't something that you're in the headspace for today, that's okay. We'll get it. We'll see you another time, or we'll see you in the next episode. But if you are along for the ride today, not only are we going to talk about Megan's case, but we're going to talk about the impacts that it had on the criminal justice system as a whole, because it was very far-reaching. Megan Kanka was born December 7th, 1986, to parents Maureen and Richard Kanka. Not much has been released about Megan or who she was as a person. Part of that is because her life was taken when she was just 7.
That's so young.
She didn't have the opportunity to grow up or grow old or do any of the things that her classmates did. Another reason for this might be that her case became national news and set a precedent in our country in a way that we're going to talk about in a little bit here, but the details of Megan the child, of Megan the person, might have been overshadowed by Megan the murdered, Megan the story.
Yeah.
So a lot of the details about her we don't have. But what we do know is that she was a sweet girl. We know that she loved her family. She had two siblings, a sister Jessica and a brother Jeremy. We know that she had just finished first grade at Frederick R. Sayen School in Hamilton Square in Hamilton Township in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And she regularly accompanied her parents to a Catholic church on Sundays.
I just have the picture in my head of
this big backpack.
Little girl with the big backpack.
And the tights. And the cute little shoes.
And the chunky socks, you know, that were probably a sensory nightmare, but she wore anyway.
Speaking from experience?
Definitely not. But seven. She had just finished first grade. What do you do in first grade? I mean, you don't even...
She probably lost a tooth. The tooth fairy was probably handing out like $5, rolling
it. Whoa, okay.
Don't spend it all in one place.
Hope not. And then, you know, your friends are still talking about, like, I don't know if kids still play with these, but like My Little Ponies and, you know, like little toys, like figurines. You're still using your imagination. You're still running outside, scraping your knees, learning to ride a bike. Like, these are just developmental milestones. And she never got past that.
She didn't even get to start the second grade because in the summer between her first and second grade, on July 29th, 1994, Megan went outside to play. As she did many times before and like every seven-year-old should, but she never came home. Her parents noticed that she'd been out a little bit longer than they'd expected. I mean, she went out to play all the time, her and her siblings. It wasn't uncommon. They lived in a relatively safe neighborhood. This wasn't anything that they had alarm bells going off in their head about, but it was of concern when they saw that her bike was left in the front yard. It was like on its side.
And yeah, that's weird.
There's kind of that like eerie thing. Like it's almost like if you can imagine it in a movie scene, like with a bike with training wheels and one still spinning on the side, you know, like in the tassels blowing in the wind. Like there's that eerie sort of thing where they're like, she wouldn't have left that there like that. She would have come in if she were going to not be riding her bike. Where is she?
I don't know. To me, tipped over says interrupted. You know, that's not like if I'm going to go wander off and I'm a kid, I'm probably not getting up and chucking it over and then walking around. I'm probably just getting off and going to see the cool flower that I looked at.
It was about 8 p.m. when they noticed that she was missing. And I mean, it's about 8 p.m. as we sit and record this. We're in New England. It's still light out. But it's starting to get dark out, and it's not quite July, but we're almost there. So this isn't the dead of night that, you know, it's, depending on the time of year, it is dark by this time. And so that's not what we're talking about here. So they are out, and they're looking around, and they're not seeing her. They called the police right away. Her family was on it.
Good.
And they searched immediately. And the word traveled so fast. This community came together. Nearly 500 people came together to search for her. And of these 500 people were policemen, firefighters, community members. Even people from other communities came over to help because they just heard of a missing little seven-year-old.
Oh, that's so good.
A helicopter flew overhead just searching for her. Bloodhounds were tracking her scent. They didn't find anything.
Right.
Neighbors joined in the search, hoping that it was a misunderstanding. Maybe she hadn't realized how late it got.
Right.
Maybe she was afraid that she was going to get in trouble. Maybe she was just still playing. I mean, she's seven. Life's great when you're seven, or it should be.
Yeah, the worst part of your day when you're seven should be having to eat your vegetables and brush your teeth before bed.
For Megan, life was great at seven. She was loved and adored by everybody who knew her. And trust me, she wasn't running away.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents noticed immediately when she wasn't there. And the community really seemed to come together for this family.
Yeah, and a pretty impressive response time, it sounds like.
To this community, this was, and it was even noted in a lot of the newspapers, as a suburban family's nightmare.
Yeah.
Your baby missing. Her bike discarded, Everyone and anyone's a suspect. You're looking twice at your neighbors. Anyone who averts their eyes or stares too long is a suspect.
Right.
I imagine the terror that her parents felt must have been tangible and suffocating.
Yeah.
But it only got worse.
Great.
Police were on it, though. They didn't accuse Megan of being a runaway, which you might scoff at, but in the decades before Megan went missing, this wasn't uncommon. Every kid right. was a runaway right up until they weren't.
Which we love that they're not, but again, we have to point out how great it is when it's not immediately discarded as that.
The police interviewed the family members, and once the family was ruled out, they moved on to the neighbors, and this is when they got their first lead.
Okay.
One of the neighbors who was helping in the search was a man who was 33 years old named Jesse Temendequaz.
Okay.
Jesse said that he was working on his car when he last saw Megan around 2 p.m., and he said that she was with a friend. But this conflicted with what he had told Maureen, Megan's mom, when she had asked him, because she had also been out asking all of the neighbors well, of when course. The last time they had seen her daughter as well. And when he talked to Maureen, he told her that he had seen Megan at 5.
Okay, so that's later.
And this conflict, coupled with the fact that another neighbor spoke up about the residents of the home that Jesse lived in, made police suspicious.
Okay, so they're suspicious. I completely understand because his stories aren't adding up between the police and Maureen, but also because of his roommates or family? Yes.
Apparently, a neighbor knew that one of Jesse's roommates was a registered sex offender.
Mm.
The home Jesse was living in was one that was diagonally across from Megan's family, was actually owned by the mother of Joseph Cifelli, who was a registered sex offender.
Okay.
So if we look at it, so this guy's mom, Mrs. Cifelli, we'll call her, sure. owns the house. Her son lives there. He's a sex offender. Jesse lives there. Jesse's a sex offender. And the other male roommates... also sex offenders.
Oh, it's a club?
So, well, there's three men total.
Okay.
So there's four people, one woman, the mom,
right.
and three younger guys, all sex offenders, who had all met incarcerated.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, that's clicking. All right.
And Jesse had actually specifically been convicted of child sex offenses. Okay. So this put him like higher up on their list to be suspicious of.
Well, of course, yeah.
But of all of the roommates in this home, Jesse was the only one who didn't have an alibi for when Megan was missing and the only one who looked nervous. And he was visibly nervous. He was shaking and sweating and anxious. But how this wasn't already at the top of the investigators' minds, I have no idea, because it is incredibly frustrating that you had someone yards away who was convicted of crimes that sound a whole lot like what you're piecing together right now, right. and you didn't immediately go to him. It's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback. It's easy to look right. back afterwards and say, well, this is what I would have done. I don't know what I would have done. I don't have that job.
Right.
I can't imagine what the pressure was like, but I can say that you need to use the tools available to you, and a pattern's a pattern.
Right. Well, and, you know, again, Allie and I try to be very cognizant of the things that we don't know. We don't know how we'd react in a situation. We don't know what we'd do. We don't know policies, procedures for that job or that person or who their supervisor is and how they are. And there's so many unknowns. But when it comes to things like this, especially where we're looking at the well-being of a child and you have, I mean, listen, I know there are multiple ways to land yourself on a sex offense registry. We talked about one last week.
Oh, we're going to talk about it later. Don't worry.
But, you know, to be a sex offender and to have a child go missing like this and you live in the neighborhood, I would expect a lot of police interaction. Even if, and honestly, I would expect a lot of it, especially if you didn't do it, because they're going to be trying really hard to rule you out or rule you in. And if it was me, I'd be really excited to show them that it wasn't me. But then again, I'm not a sex offender, so I don't know. But it's interesting to me that he could be that visibly nervous and that they could have that information on him, because they would have that. They have access to all of the jail and prison records, you know, but then to not really follow up with it. So did they just stop after the interview?
Well, here's the thing. A neighbor clued in the police to say, hey, this other guy, Joseph Cifelli, I know he's a sex offender.
Oh, okay.
That was the only reason they kind of set their sights on this. I mean, this home. They were really looking at that guy.
Right.
Okay. And then they're like, okay, let's look at the roommates. Who else lives here? What's going on? I mean, this is the house directly across from Megan's home.
Right. Okay.
But somebody else had to point them in that direction. It wasn't like they got there on their own.
Okay.
But they should've. It also
makes sense because they wouldn't have like waved them down and been like, hey there, Mr. Officer. Do you want to know about my past?
Exactly.
Right.
But when investigators did speak with Jesse a couple of times, they noticed a couple things. One of the things that they noticed between the first and second time was that someone had taken the trash out between the two meetings. With okay. consent from the homeowner, the mother of Joseph, to search the premises, they searched in the trash because they could.
Right, of course.
And inside the trash, they found, quote, a rope with some knots tied in it.
Oh.
And a substance that appeared to be dried blood.
Oh.
And also parts of what appeared to be tattered child's clothing. They thought to be like a waistband of a child's pair of pants. They had seized these items, and Maureen had been tasked with the unimaginable responsibility of confirming that the blood-soaked items did, in fact, belong to her missing 7-year-old daughter. Jesse was questioned at the police station, where he remained mostly tight-lipped, but when he did speak, his story just seemed to be ever-evolving. First, he hadn't seen her at all. Then he saw her at 2 p.m., maybe. Then he saw her around 5. Then it was 5:30, sometimes with a friend, maybe not. It was impossible to follow. Ugh. When questioned about what was found in the trash, he said that those were rags from work, not clothing. So not kids' clothing. That's not blood. This is from work. I just got rid of it. He had what looked like a cut on his hand. So okay. they used this as sort of a way in to have a conversation with him. What's this cut on your hand? How did you get that? Right. When did you get that?
What's new, dude? Yeah.
He said that the cut on his hand was like from a bar in his car or something like that. Like he cut it on something in his car. So they said, oh, okay, can we confirm that? And he was like, yeah, sure. But what this did was allow them access to his car.
Right.
And when they did look at it, they did not find blood where he said they would, because he did not, in fact, injure his hand that way. They didn't find anything to suggest that that part of his story was true at all.
Huh.
Wouldn't
you? Funny how that works.
Yeah. He's a funny looking fella.
Don't you know?
He did actually, though, consent to a polygraph test. Idiot. Failed it.
Of course.
Did another one. Failed that.
Yeah.
And then thinking the third time's the charm, he tried it again and soiled it.
He said, Mama didn't raise no quitter.
Yeah. So he failed 3 polygraph tests. And I don't have stock in polygraph results, and you shouldn't either. But for this guy, this does not look good.
No, and I would also say, like, there are so many different ways to influence or see a different outcome on a polygraph test than what is true. It is a very nice piece of additional evidence. It is just not necessarily something I would base my entire opinion on alone. But also, it really doesn't help your case if you're like, nah, 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 again, again.
Like, if you fail the first one, take the L and move on, dude.
Yep, because you're probably not going to not fail the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And now instead of just one, that you could say, hey, polygraphs are kind of fucked. What's like, up with that?
Like, put me in, coach. Like, They're like, no.
You asked for it 2 more times and failed it 2 more times again. So this isn't like user error, you know?
Exactly. And polygraphs, we know they're not admissible in court. We know that you're not getting this concrete, factual, like, I've got this and I'm going to run with it information. But what it can do is give you a good direction to point in. So if you have like these clusters of questions where the answers can point you in the certain direction, you might actually get a start. So the answers were vague on these kinds of questions. Well, have you ever talked to her? Did you ever, did you interact with her today? Well, you passed the question about killing her. I don't know. But you didn't about talking to her. So maybe you know who did. You know what I mean? So maybe we dig a little bit here. So walk me through your day.
Right.
What, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know the specifics of the questions he was asked. What I do know is he fucked them all up.
Right.
And for some reason, he was more confident than I would have been, and he continued to do it. But regardless, after the third one, he was like, yeah, I probably shouldn't do that again.
Well, it's nice that he cut his losses.
Or they were just like, we're not wasting our time on this again. But
fair.
Either way, he was interviewed for like 6 hours.
Holy crap.
But then he made a request. And this was like the first thing that he had asked for. So he asked if he could speak with his roommate, Brian. So again, there were three male roommates. One was Joseph. The other is Brian.
Okay. Joseph and Brian. Okay.
Correct. Okay. They bring Brian in. So they do actually, I guess, meet him halfway here and like, okay. But I think what they're thinking here is he's not willing to talk with us. He's giving us nothing. But he seems to be willing to talk to his roommate. So we'll see what he gives him. So they bring Brian in and Brian just goes, you're caught, dude.
Shit.
He literally said, and I quote, they got you. They got you. They got you. You're going to need a friend on the outside. I'll be that friend.
Holy crap. Brian, hand it to him on a silver platter, why don't you?
I'm like, does Brian want a job? Like, Brian just, because the next thing out of Jesse's mouth, he hung his head and he said she's in Mercer County Park.
Brian needs to be like an investigator.
I mean, Brian's like, I'll do your dirty work on the outside, okay. I guess, and like put money on your commissary, but yeah, I mean, but it...
That's an impressive...
I think Jesse was hoping to either be told like they got nothing on you or whatever. I think Brian saw the way they like tore up the house at home, tore up his car, looked into everything. Like his roommate saw everything from the outside and all the stuff stacked against him that I think he was like, dude, they like.
Right.
I mean, he literally said they got you 3 times.
Yeah.
Like as many times as he failed a polygraph test, they said... He said they got you.
Well, and also, you know, I'm just thinking in my little brain, right? And how people learn and adapt and evolve. Sure. Maybe Jesse's hoping that Brian gets called in and says, listen, man, this is what you need to do. It gets you out of here. Or you have this loophole you can go through. And then
I think he was grasping at straws. You're like the only person that might be able to help me who's local right now, and he's just like, you're fucked.
Yeah. And then so he says she's in what park?
So he tells Brian, who of course, like, the police are listening, like,
right,
they're aware. He said she's in Mercer County Park.
Okay.
So from there, Jesse led investigators to her body. She was found with a bag over her head in the park he said she'd be in, but her body had been discarded under brush and in long grass and weeds, just left there, abandoned. But the details of what happened to Megan before she died only became public when Jesse went to trial for her murder the next year. So he went to trial October of 1995, over a year after her death.
Wow.
So here's what we know.
Okay.
Jesse lured Megan into his home with the promise of seeing his new puppy.
Not the puppy.
And really, he did have a puppy. She'd probably even seen it before.
Right.
And who doesn't want to see a puppy?
I want to see a puppy.
I instantly become 7 again when I see a puppy. My fiance, I get to marry him. I feel so lucky. I swear he goes, oh, geez. When we see a dog, he's like, oh, ooh, poopers. And I have to go pet them. Like, I would be lured into that van. I would be sucked away. Like, And as a child, without having been told by my parents, and I was, you know, but had that not been something, had that stranger danger piece and the don't go with strangers thing had not been like so ingrained into all of us.
Right. Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't
you? You get to go see a puppy.
But here's the thing. This is your neighbor. You live in a relatively safe place where you've grown up playing with your neighbor's kids. Like, your community is your community. These are the people that live directly across from you. You're 7 years old. You don't have any reason to believe the world is bad. You've seen this dog before. And
even if
you want to see, who doesn't want to see a puppy, dude? If someone called me right now and said, do you want to come over and see a puppy? I'd put my shoes on.
Yes. Right now. Right. Call us.
Like, I got to go. I'm going to see a puppy.
I'm kidding. But the other thing, too, is like when you're seven, even if you do think that someone could be bad or could be mean, proximity and exposure are the closest thing you have to trust. So if you've been there your entire 7 years, nothing bad has ever happened. You've seen this puppy and now you get a chance to go see it. You're damn right. You're going to go see the puppy. You're going to pet its little head and its ears are going to be really soft and they're going to boop its wet little nose and you're going to kiss it and go, aww, because that's what everybody does when you, the seven-year-old, kisses the puppy.
We are women in our mid-20s asking you guys for pod pet pictures. Like, we fucking love animals. But here's the thing. Cases like Megan's are the reason why we have this, like, hey, no, you, no one needs your help looking for their dog or their cat. No, you can't see their bunny. No, they don't have candy for you.
No, nobody's Nana makes way too much accidentally and it's just overflowing the backseat of that big white van.
No, like, they don't need your help with anything. Like, but it's cases like these because it did happen before, because we didn't know enough or it wasn't talked about enough and it did happen, that now these are why these things are ingrained in us. And unfortunately, this is what happened to Megan, because why wouldn't she have believed him?
Right.
He lived across the street and she went with him. Megan agreed because, like me, you, and everyone else, she wanted to give rump rubs and chin scritches and treats to all the good boys and girls.
Yeah.
And tell them just how good they are. But according to an article by the LA Times, prosecution said during the trial, unsuspecting, trusting 7-year-old Megan walked into the defendant's house and she would never walk out. That man, the defendant, had been watching that little girl for months.
Ugh.
And it's true.
I bet.
Jesse had noticed Megan months prior, and he had developed an attraction to her.
That's a child.
7-year-old, doe-eyed, innocent Megan. So he lay in wait for his opportunity. And when she agreed to go with him, he took her into the home he shared with his roommates, but it was empty. Because again, they all had alibis. They were all out at work or doing whatever it was they were doing, but he was not.
Right.
And Megan didn't see a puppy. And she got kind of nervous. But he brought her into his room anyway, and he tried to kiss her.
Oh.
And she resisted, and she screamed, and she tried to run away. And he got afraid. And he couldn't risk her telling her mom, who might tell the police. Because for Jesse, this wasn't something that could be swept under the rug as a misunderstanding. And there wasn't room to place blame on a child with an active imagination, because Jesse had a history.
Right.
A lot of it.
Oh.
You see, in 1981, Jesse took a 5-year-old girl into the woods.
Five.
Once there, he pulled down her pants. He was either interrupted or she got away, because thankfully, to my understanding, it didn't go further than that, but he was arrested.
Good.
His sentence was suspended on the condition that he participate in required counseling. He didn't. He served minimal time, a few months, I believe. And just a year after that, he was convicted of attempted sexual assault of a 7-year-old girl. He choked her to unconsciousness, and when she was found, she was blue. He was sentenced to 10 years. But while incarcerated, I'm sure he got to read, watch TV, work out, and most importantly, make friends. And he did. He was released after only 6 years due to good behavior.
And he moved. Because there's no fucking infants to rape when you're in prison with grown men. Sorry, I know. Just can we just fucking stop with good behavior when your victim type is not around you? That's not good behavior.
I'm sure he said please and thank you to all the guards. I'm sure he was a model inmate because girls under the age of 10 weren't there.
Ugh. Ugh.
But he did move in with two friends that he made in prison that were also sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
While he was incarcerated, he participated in the least amount of programming he possibly could, but just enough for a mental health worker to believe he would reoffend. So that's comforting.
Oh, good.
Jesse was given every single opportunity to get help, to make change, to participate in treatment, remain in the community, and he showed time and time again that he would reoffend, that he was dangerous. And you can give someone every opportunity to do the right thing, and some people never will, and that is their choice. The home he moved into upon his release was across the street from where Maureen and Rich were unknowingly raising their three young kids. When Megan screamed and tried to run away from his grasp, he knew he'd go back to prison.
Of course.
He had to make sure that she could never tell anybody. And he said, quote, "I was afraid she'd tell her mother. I was afraid I'd go to jail." Let me correct something. You wouldn't go to jail, asshole. You'd go to prison.
As you should. And I hope everybody there knows what you did to those young kids, because that's not going to go well for you.
He claimed that as she tried to leave and as he tried to stop her, she hit her head on the door frame. And again, we only have him to ask. So this is his version of events. And of course, we can't ask Megan. She apparently hit her head on the door frame and the door handle in their struggle.
Sure.
And he hit her across the face and her head was slammed into his dresser. She began to bleed. Head wounds bleed a lot.
Yeah.
And he claimed that he only put the bag over her head to stop the blood from getting all over his room because it was going to make a mess.
Sure.
He said he used a belt to strangle her and he sexually assaulted her several times. I'm unsure if it was a combination of both before and after she died. I know that her body was assaulted after she died, and I believe that she was raped beforehand, too. He put her body in a toy box. I don't know why. I don't know an innocent reason why a grown man had a toy box.
Yeah, that's... But for me, that... I mean...
We'll leave that there. He put her body in that toy box and moved the box to his truck so that he could move her without drawing attention to himself. He drove his truck to Mercer Park and left her body in the tall grass. But before he left, he brutalized her one more time.
Oh, yeah.
When he went home, Maureen approached him and asked if he'd seen Megan. Her daughter was missing. He was their neighbor after all. Maureen said later that he was very normal speaking, calm, very matter of fact. She'd actually never spoken to him before.
Yeah.
She thought he'd seemed nice enough. The conversation was maybe 10 seconds.
Right, because what are you going to say? Nah, maybe a few hours ago with a friend or something. Good luck.
Fibers in his room matched fibers found on Megan's body. The cut on his hand wasn't a cut at all. It was a bite mark. Megan fought for her life, and good she fought girl. Back hard. During her autopsy, her lower jaw had to be removed to make the molds so that they can confirm that the wound on his hand was actually from her. And this was a point that the prosecutor made sure that the jury heard. I won't bore you or insult you with some of what defense counsel presented. They had an impossible case. The jury was urged not to take his confession too seriously, to which they said, yeah, no. Among other charges, he was found guilty of her murder, kidnapping, and aggravated sexual assault. But next up was the sentencing phase. And given New Jersey statutes in the 1990s, his conviction made Jesse eligible for the death penalty. Evidence was presented on Jesse's behalf that allegedly, he had a dysfunctional childhood. And I won't say he definitely didn't, but it doesn't excuse this. His mother...
Yeah, you know what? There are plenty of people who get fucked up in childhood that go on to not fuck up other children.
His mom had 10 kids by 7 different men with unsavory characters in and out of the home doing God knows what to those kids. His mom struggled with alcohol use and didn't offer what a parent should have in terms of love, support, or protection. And his dad didn't either. He, too, struggled with alcohol. And according to one of Jesse's brothers, his name's Paul, their father sexually assaulted them both several times a week.
Okay.
These facts were presented as mitigating factors, but ultimately the jury did sentence him to death.
Yeah.
Many of the jurors in the penalty phase struggled with the decision.
Understandable. You're taking someone's life.
John Groton, one of those jurors, said, quote, "I'm a Christian, and for me it was hard to justify this verdict. A lot of us were looking for something that would let us not give this sentence, but we didn't find it."
Yeah.
Jesse appealed his conviction. Who hasn't? You've got nothing but time. Of course he did.
Who hasn't, David?
But his appeal was founded in some logic from another planet.
Really?
Yes. They argued the fact, and it's confusing and it's shitty, but like this is where they tried to go. They argued the fact that he was already in prison. So the fact that he was already in prison should serve as a mitigating factor.
How?
So real quick, we'll talk about mitigating and aggravating factors a lot here. So aggravating factors are ones that can make punishment more harsh because the nature of the crime is worse versus a mitigating factor, which can make punishment less harsh. So, right. For example, like there's DUI and an aggravated DUI. DUI is driving under the influence. Aggravating factors might be that like a child's in the car. That's going to make that worse. Or going twice the speed limit. That's going to make that worse. Or causing bodily injury to somebody else, that's going to make that worse. So those might be aggravating factors. And those might be considered during the sentencing phase of things. So talking about these factors, Jesse's legal team argued the fact that he was incarcerated meant he was no longer a threat to children, and this should serve as a mitigating factor, and his death penalty sentence should be overturned. Like, he shouldn't be sentenced to death because he's already in prison, so he's not a threat to kids anymore. They threw that the fuck out and said, like, just because you were caught doesn't mean you get a lesser sentence. Like, the sentence itself doesn't serve as a mitigating factor, you dumb fuck.
Right, and it's kind of going with that, like, DUI example, right? Like, a mitigating factor for one of those might be, like, you had one drink at a bar, but it was roofied. So you didn't know you were that intoxicated. You waited the proper amount of time and it's still in your blood system, right? So they find that out. They investigate. That's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Your sentence or your punishment will likely be less. But if you are twice over the legal limit with a kid in the car, just because they caught you and now you're sober because right now you're not drunk, doesn't mean that you didn't do that fucking thing.
Or like right now you're in prison, so you are currently not drinking, which means that doesn't mean anything. So regardless, his appeal was very kindly rejected.
Good.
But there is so much I want to include about the aftermath of this case because we have so much to say. And if you'll notice, there's quite some time left in this episode. That is not because it is dead silence. We have a lot to say.
Right.
On August 2nd, 1994, just mere days after Megan's murder, again, she died in late July of 94, Hamilton, New Jersey hosted a rally as part of National Night Out campaign.
Okay.
Which, if you've ever participated in one, I have. They happen all over the country, and it's an anti-crime campaign. Actually, Abby and I have both done that.
Yes, we have.
On this particular night, many showed up wearing pink ribbons in Megan's memory.
Aww.
Maureen told the crowd, "Light your candles on your porches and think of my little girl."
Mm.
Maureen and Richard became powerhouses of legislative change.
Yes.
Lighting a fire under the asses of lawmakers and demanding that families know who is in the neighborhood so they can protect their kids. A few months later, in October of 1994... then Governor Christy Todd Whitman signed the first Megan's Law.
Hey!
And so this is the law that we're talking about today. This is the law that set precedent over, I mean, at least nationally in the United States, but actually globally, a lot of countries then adopted some version of Meghan's Law.
I love that.
Because of what happened to Meghan Kanga. And in this version of Meghan's Law, it required the community be made aware when a sex offender moves to the community. The Kankas and the Wengert family, which were both families who had lost a young child to a sexual predator, were in attendance when the governor said, quote, "You are truly, truly amazing people. You and your families have taken and turned the darkest in yours or any family's lives and turned them into a statewide, even nationwide campaign to protect children. Because of you, we are changing laws and we are hopefully going to save lives."
Wow.
Meghan's Law became a federal law, and every state has some version of it, but the criteria may vary. So what I say about Meghan's Law is sort of generalized, and it doesn't mean that that's specific for your state. So you can look up your version of it, but your state does have one.
Yes.
Meghan's Law is an addition to the Jacob Wetterling Crimes Against Children and Sexually Violent Offender Registration Act. Avid listeners might remember this from episode 52 when we covered Jacob's case.
Yes, we did.
If you couldn't tell, crimes against children really get to me.
You did a great job on that one.
Jacob's family fought to institute a sex offender registry, as one didn't exist when their son was murdered in 1989 by a local sex offender. So the addition of Meghan's Law made this registry easily accessible and required law enforcement to notify community members when an individual on that list moves in.
Yeah, that's so huge.
Just to reiterate, Meghan's Law is the law that makes it so much more easily accessible to find out who the members of the sex offender registry are, where they live, and if one moves into your neighborhood, you have to be notified.
Right. Jacob, his case helped create it. So he is the reason there is a registry. Hers Correct. Is the reason you can learn about it.
Yeah. So the registry exists, and that was mostly so law enforcement had a place to start.
Right.
If like a kid went missing or something, it was like, okay, they're all organized in some kind of database where you can look at them and investigators could know where to start. That was one of them.
Right.
But Meghan's Law says families need to know too. Community members need to know too. Adults need to know.
Yeah. Because there, once again, are plenty of things that can land you on that list.
So this law set the groundwork for all 50 states to enforce notification, and again, has even impacted other countries to do the same. So I'll link some more information about this in our show notes. While Meghan's Law, in my opinion, and I speak only for myself, is a common sense law, there are some, like in everything, who wholeheartedly disagree. And I'm not going to omit information or opinions I disagree with just because right. I disagree with them. So I will share them with you. There are several groups who believe this law and the Jacob Wetterling Act encourage vigilante justice, and that the announcement and advertisement of this criminal history makes the offender and their families potential targets of crime.
Okay.
One of these groups is called Women Against Registry, and their acronym really is WAR, which sounds fitting. This nonprofit organization hosts its headquarters in Arnold, Missouri, and their mission is to inform lawmakers and other players of the harm that registries can and have caused, they say.
Okay.
Most of their members are wives, mothers, girlfriends, other family members of a person convicted of a sexual offense.
Sounds right.
It's their opinion that registries offer a hit list of sorts.
Okay.
Bear with me. We'll get through this and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
One point they make is that there's no evidence that the registration has made communities safer, which I think would be an incredibly difficult statistic to find anyway. Sex crimes are the least reported crime ever.
And how can you...
There could be 100 victims or there could be 10, and it doesn't mean that either group of those are going to be recorded. And I would also likely ask them to provide statistics on how many hit list vigilante crimes are committed. Maybe they have them, but I'd like to see it.
Also, it's pretty hard to say that it doesn't make a community safer, because how can you provide statistics on crimes that didn't happen?
So, no.
But, okay. All right. Continue.
Another point they make is that the blanket law eliminated any judicial discretion regarding who has to register and who doesn't, meaning that the judges don't have the option to enforce one and not the other, even if there are mitigating circumstances. And there are a few situations where I believe that this is relevant.
Yeah, sure.
And unfortunately, I hate that this... some of these like common sense points are grouped in with these overarching things that I so very much disagree with, that I'm like, I disagree with your whole organization. And even though there's some things in here I
see
that, yeah, I can understand because of the overarching like thing you stand for, like,
right,
you sway a little bit, I'm afraid it goes all the way, and I like, no, these things should still be in place, but I can see your point on these other things.
Right.
So, for example, mitigating circumstances might include if a 16-year-old sends a nude photo to a 17-year-old boyfriend.
Yep.
Depending on the laws, the boyfriend could be charged with receiving or possession of child pornography.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
That's
should
insane.
That be treated as less than, more than, or equal to an adult over 18 committing a violent sexual act against a child under 10? You tell me. I also feel in cases like this that sometimes those charges are actually pled down because of those circumstances.
Right.
So sometimes it doesn't get to that, like, it doesn't get that far. Like, during the court phase of things, those charges will get dropped down to something else so that those charges don't require a registry anyway. Right. But I can see the point being made that's not always a given, and maybe discretion is taken away in some of those instances too. I don't know. I won't pretend to be an expert on all 50 states. I'm not even an expert on the one I live in. So, right, you know, that could be concerning, but you know, at the root here are humans. Human prosecutors, judges, defense attorneys, victims, their families, offenders, their families. No two situations are going to be the exact same. So
no,
just think on it. But if the goal of these nonprofit organizations is to abolish the registry, I disagree. But I do agree that we should consider revising some specific criteria.
Sure.
I don't believe that two 16-year-olds should be labeled as sex offenders because they sexted once in high school. Nor do I believe someone urinating in the woods, arrested for public indecency, should be listed next to more violent sexual offenses on a sex offender registry with no distinction.
Right.
In our rush to pass legislation to protect potential future victims, did we create victims? Did we create more holes, more problems? And I think that these are important conversations to have. Abby and I like to learn. We're big nerds, if you didn't notice from the beginning of this episode. And difficult conversations are important, and we're okay with having those here because no one's going to jump down your throat. We're just not like that.
No. And we like to see the different perspectives. We like to do it in the cases that we tell, but we also like to do it in the real world application of this. Like, for me, part of the interest I have in true crime is that it's true. It's real life. It impacts people. It impacted people with what happened, and their victimization continues to impact other people with the way that they learn to trust or not, or look at people in the world, or just the way that they maneuver themselves based off of those traumas. But when it comes to legislation, I think sort of in a very similar point here, we do whatever we can to protect what we know, but oftentimes we don't stop to think about what we don't yet. And I don't think that this should be abolished in the slightest. Amended is significantly different. And amending things is good. That's a sign of progress. That's a sign of growth. But agreed. I think if you are peeing in the middle of the woods and a cop happens to be walking by,
or like you're peeing in a campsite and like a couple of teenagers walk by, you have like public indecency in front of children. Like, whoa, did that blow out of
right
proportion? But is that the same as somebody actually flashing children, right? And that happens. And so,
right. And even, I would even say, I mean, I don't love the idea that you're in a spot where kids could be there, but technically a kid could be anywhere. Like, I think you need to take a look at the setting and the intention and what their thought process was. And that's hard to do because oftentimes when it comes to people who do want to hurt kids, they're not going to tell you their thought process, at least not honestly.
But the issue is that in this situation, had Maureen and Rich known who their neighbors were, they likely would have told their kids not to speak to those neighbors.
Right.
They're not safe. No, you can't pet that puppy.
You cannot go over to that house.
You're not, like, that's a no-go zone. You can't go there. You only play outside when mommy's on the porch.
Right.
Like, they...
It changes the way you do things.
And whether it would or wouldn't, the fight from the families and from the Kankas specifically is like, you should have that information. What you do with it is what you do with it.
Right.
But it's what... It's having that knowledge, so you're aware of that. But then the other side of it was like, well, how much does that infringe? And it's like, well, it's public record. Yes. History is public record.
I was going to say, when you were talking about the organization, the Women Against Registries, was it?
Yeah, let's just call them War. The War, because they, you know.
War
nice.
Org.
That's nice.
When you were talking about them saying that it creates a hit list, you know what? So does your local newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
You look up last night's arrest. So does
the local DUI list if you want to. Anything yeah. can be a list if you want it to be.
Honestly, you just have to write it down on the same paper. Mm-hmm. So, like, I understand not wanting to maybe lump people in that are in an unfortunate circumstance, right? You just turned 17. Your girlfriend's about to turn 17.
Mm-hmm.
It still sucks. Technically, legislatively, yeah, that could be a crime, depending on what happens.
But those might be mitigating circumstances.
That gets it pled down.
So that it gets dropped altogether. Because,
right.
yeah, this isn't a criminal matter that we need to deal with here. But with someone like Jesse, who had two priors of, like, violent offenses against
violent sex
crimes
offenses.
Against children, who was given every single opportunity to engage in counseling and didn't, and still got out early on good behavior. Like, how do you,
even with someone saying hello,
like, how do you not do what was required of you and still get out early? That's not so. And I'm sure he was great. Again, I'm sure he made his bed, like, you
so
bet
good.
Your ass
hospital
he did
corners,
it
so tight.
He did it just fucking so good, man.
Dare I say, and I may.
Go ahead. You will.
That oftentimes sex offenders do not become a sex offender by being creepy.
No.
It's hard to get access to kids.
This fucker's creepy looking, though. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
well, I'll show you guys him on the Instagram. You let us know.
But it's hard to get access to kids, or at least to have, like, adults trust you around kids or not get a bad vibe if you're like, so is she in a training bra yet? Like, that.
But if you say, oh, do you want to see my puppy?
Right. And
I'll
you're
go right now.
Polite and kind. And the parents
Snowball.
Have no reason to be like, oh, I get a weird feeling. That gains you more access to your victim pool. And I don't know about you, but if somebody's looking to victimize someone, they want more access to them.
Correct.
So they're probably not going to be the creepy guy from fucking Family Guy who's, like, always trying to touch Chris or something. That's not a very good representation of who's the biggest risk to your kids.
Right.
But also, the idea of getting rid of something that is a public record anyway, it's just more consolidated, which is actually just better for people who are looking things up, because then you don't find everybody else's name.
But there's a funny... We talked about this, I feel like, a year ago when Abby and I were, like, just watching old TV shows. We were binging Reno 911.
Yes.
And there's an episode where a sex offender moves to the neighborhood, and it's, you couldn't make it today. You know, it's one of those where,
oh,
like,
he is a creepy looking fucker. Sorry.
And they you looked the guy up, Jesse.
Yeah, I did.
So So in Reno 911, you know, the officer's bringing the guy around and he's got to go introduce himself. You know, it's got to be, there's a witness. Someone needs to be there. All the neighbors are made aware that there's a sex offender in the neighborhood. And so
right.
they like approach the neighbors. And I think one of them, he goes up and he's just like, so like, I'm a Patriots fan. I'm a Gemini or a sex offender. And he's like, what was that? I'm a sex offender. You know what? It's just yep. but the joke of it. But you can see real life in all of that to say, you will see it even in media, jokes about yep. it. But it is a real thing, and it only is a real thing. And the notification process is only real because Megan's family fought so hard to say, listen, we had no idea. And had we known,
this would have changed the way we operated.
We would have changed the rules, like our household rules would have been different. They would have been dependent on this. They lived diagonal. We could see their house from our house.
Right.
And our kids would have known that house, and they would have known not to go into that house. They would have known not to talk to anybody from that house.
Right.
Then it should have been for us to decide what we do with that information, not for anybody else to know it and not tell us.
And I think something that organizations like WAR or people who are against these registries, it is so degrading to the 7-year-old, the not yet second grade, barely probably writing, reading books like Hop on Pop from Dr. Fucking Seuss, 7-year-old, her life, what it could have been, what it was, who she would have grown into be, what she could have done, mm-hmm. all of that was taken away. And you're angry that it's notified or that it's noted
mm-hmm.
who did it.
Like, if you're upset that a family member can't make it to your school recital or your graduation or anything like that, your issue isn't with a registry. It isn't with the law. It's likely with your family member and what they've done. I say likely with. Now, likely. If it's one of the situations where it shouldn't be what it is, you know, those situations happen. And those are the things where I think we need a remedy for, or at least a second look at. But what I don't agree with is some blanket rule that just allows all of this to be dropped.
Right.
Or where everybody is like, everyone has the book thrown at them. Because yes. the two 16-year-olds who send a Snapchat to each other, I think, is probably more likely than sexting now. I don't know. What do the kids do? Don't tell me.
I don't want to know. No. But that.
We're going to get in trouble if someone... don't tell
yeah,
me.
I don't want to know. Don't... yeah. We're out. But let's be ignorant.
But things that are like, not with the forethought that this is going to be life-changing. You're both kids. You're both idiots. You're both horny little dummies.
Yep. And I'm going to throw out there, once again, you know, we talk about the fact that justice doesn't always happen. I spent 2 hours talking about it last week. But if you have a crime, at least in the United States, you need to willingly make that happen and have the intent of doing it. So me myself, willfully driving drunk is different than the woman whose drink is roofied and thought she waited enough time.
Looking at you, Justin Timberlake. What?
Ooh. Cry me a river. And also, like, when it comes to two 16-year-olds, the intent to victimize or exploit somebody, it's not there. And yes, there are a few crimes that you don't need the intent for, but those are like murder, okay? And two 16-year-olds being horny on Maine, that's not the same thing. And I don't want to know.
On Maine? What's that?
Like, maybe it's like a Tumblr thing. Ooh, I'm dating
is that an
myself.
App? Wait, is it MAME?
No. It's like a... back in the day.
Wait, am I old? Are you explaining something to me back in the day? Am I that?
I think I'm explaining to you Tumblr culture, but that makes me feel old. So people would be like, not to be horny on Maine, and then they'd like post something.
Oh,
horny.
Like on the Maine feed.
Yes. So not like their secret account or their spam account.
Gotcha,
like,
gotcha,
not to
gotcha.
Be horny on Maine. Okay. Not to put it out there.
Oh God, I'm such a nerd. What's that? What are the kids doing? What's Maine? Is that an app?
That girl, that was like,
sorry,
15 years ago. So anyway, you're not old, I'm old. So
we're the same age.
Tumblr would beg to differ.
Well,
but But I don't know. All of that is to say most crimes you need to intend to commit to be convicted of it as a crime. So, yes, there are times when justice is not served. We talked about it. Yes, there are exceptions to this rule. But primarily, when it comes to something like a sex offense towards a child.
Or two priors and then a third one. And we let this guy out already. Like, everyone involved in that should have shame. I hope you have trouble sleeping. Like, this is... There are problems here. And it's bigger than... The problem isn't the fact that we have a registry or notification. The problem is how we're dealing with offenders and those who don't want help, those who don't want to change, those who don't want to participate in treatment. You can't make somebody want that.
No, and I think that the problem is not that we are consolidating a list of people that you could find if you Googled anyway. And it's not that we are trying to help people in that situation. I think genuinely, and this is really hard because a lot of people who get into rehabilitative counseling and counseling for people who are incarcerated are doing so because they believe people can be good and can change. I think we need to start to recognize and be okay with the fact that some people don't want to. And it's not that they can't. It's not that the capability isn't there. It's their choice. And yeah, sometimes you just have to believe what they're showing you. Okay, great. He's a fine guy to talk to in session an hour a week with every other man who'd beat the living shit out of him if they knew what he did to kids.
Yep.
And then when he talks to you individually and he still says creepy things about how cute elementary school age kids are, you need to believe that. You need to remember that and then not say, oh, it's okay though. You know, he hasn't talked about it in group.
Right.
And that's not to, again, I'm not blaming people. I'm just saying there are... No,
his actions are his actions. But when there are warning signs and we still say, well, he had excellent behavior, so like, let's let him out. And then he doesn't engage in the required court-ordered treatment while he's out. And then we let him stay out. Like,
right.
There's more than one person at fault here.
Yes. And ultimately, like, cases like this are so hard. You almost certainly see a 7-year-old in your life, whether that is in your family or your own child or a cousin or
you go to the grocery store,
or the mall. And oh my God, they're so annoying because they're screaming because they want that toy that's at eye level. And their parents are like, no, we are not getting another stuffed elephant. We're done.
I have so many stuffed elephants. I love stuffed elephants. I feel
connected.
Oh, okay. Oh, sure. I feel seen but isolated. Well, but anyway,
like, you see these kids. The issue is not the kid. The issue is not recognizing what's happened. The issue is not even making a list. In fact, if I'm being honest with you, my solution to the sex offense list being bad is more lists.
That's just the ADHD in you.
I think it's that mixed with the OCD. But if I'm on it, like, I'm serious. Like, make it for each offense then if you're that worried about it. Because I would...
You just want them color-coded, shit.
Talk Excel to me. Yes.
Say it again, but slower.
And put in that auto sum function. But that's the thing. I would rather see a billion different lists that were maintained and well-kept so that I could look up, did this guy brutally sexually assault a 10-year-old, or did he take a piss in the woods at 1 a.m.?
And that's the thing. A piss in the woods at 1 a.m. shouldn't be on the list. Any sexual conduct with a 10-year-old should be on the list. To me, yes. There's one list, and you if you're on it, you deserve to be. That's right. How I am.
And I think...
But if you want all your highlighters, that's cool, too.
I love a highlighter, but...
I think neither of us are going to get our way.
No, I don't think we will potentially ever. I hope we do someday, but... I'm fine with anything. I just want to say an amending is different than an abolishment. And I think this rings true for so many different areas of our life.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, we need to work on fixing things, not throwing them out.
Correct.
As for
Jesse, he is currently residing in New Jersey State Prison, where he will be until he simply ceases to exist.
So what happened to the death penalty?
Well, in 2007, New Jersey abolished the death penalty. So his sentence was commuted to life in prison. I mean, her family was upset about this, but there's nothing that they could do about it. So he'll just be there till he dies anyway.
Yeah.
The Kanka family faced additional struggles. According to the Trentonian, their son, Jeremy, experienced nightmares after his sister's murder. And their daughter, Jessica, said that Megan had visited her once in a dream and showed her everything that happened.
Oh.
The home where Megan was murdered was actually set to be torn down. But before it was, a detective let Maureen into the home and actually into the room where Megan died.
Wow.
And Maureen said she felt, quote, a tingling all over my body. It was so strong, I had to sit down on the bed. I think she hugged me in that room.
Oh.
I had complete closure.
They sound like phenomenal people.
20 years after Megan's death, Maureen and Richard Kanka offered an exclusive interview with Daily Mail. They're grandparents now.
Aw.
They said, quote, I know we made an impact. Richard said, we sacrificed a lot, hopefully to save a lot. He said he offers help to other families and that he can't say no. Whenever they ask me, I'll be there.
Mm.
In her memory, a garden was planted in the spot where Megan's body was found.
Good.
To donate to the maintenance of that garden, donations can be made to Megan's Place Fund on GoFundMe.
That's so good. I love that.
So that is the case of Megan Kanka and the origin of Megan's Law.
That's insane. That's so hard.
So I would love to hear from our listeners. I know we tossed around a lot of different theories, ideas, thoughts. I want to know what you guys think. I don't know that there's a right answer. I just know that I have an opinion today and it could change.
Yeah.
With the more information I have. What I do know is Jesse's where he should be. And he should have been there before. I mean, he should have been there long before he did anything to Megan. And I agree with the registry, and I agree with Megan's Law and the Jacob Wetterling Act, and I agree with, even though there are consequences of that, there are consequences of everything. It's the ones that you can live with.
Yep.
And I think that we should try to weed out and utilize discretion where possible. And I don't know how we go about that, but I don't agree that somebody peeing in the woods deserves the spot next to someone like Jesse.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe they deserve a spot, period.
Not on this list.
But I don't agree with getting rid of the list. And I feel sorry for the families that are negatively impacted on the offender side. But
mostly I feel really relieved for the kids whose parents get to know who's a threat in their neighborhood. I think I'm totally with you on every point you made. I'm pro list.
You just like everything out of my mouth, huh?
I do.
You little flirt.
Yeah, what can I say? I'm pro list. I'm pro so many lists. I'm pro every list, probably. I am negative putting a guy who's peeing in the woods next to this monster. I am going to formally rescind my at New Jersey abolishing the death penalty. I have a lot of mixed feelings on it, but actually I'd really rather us as a society take the moral high road and not, you know, do the same thing that murderers do if we're gonna pick one. And ultimately, you know, I just hope everybody in that prison knows what he's done. I really do. I hope he can't hide from that. I hope there's no fake story he gets away with saying. I hope every person who enters that prison knows what has happened.
I hope they all pee in his Cheerios.
Oh my God, every day.
I hope he doesn't even get Cheerios. He gets like the shitty off-brand like
No honey either.
Cheer-O's.
Yeah, just brand.
Just O's.
Yeah. Not, fuck it. You know what? Not even. Just just the apostrophe. I hope that Megan's family is able to heal and move forward in the best way that they can. It sounds like they have done a phenomenal job taking this pain and turning it into progress.
I believe, I could be wrong, I believe Megan's mom has since passed away. To me, I just like to think of them together.
Yeah.
Now. And
now they get to hug each other in whatever room they want. And that's good.
Yeah, exactly. They get to be together and do whatever it is that they want to, free from this shit.
You know, I'm going to just take a little moment to be grateful for all the ways we already have grown. Obviously, we talk and we know and we say all of the things that we see and all of the ways that we can continue to grow and prevent more harm and keep things even better. But truly, because of this, because of Jacob Wetterling, because of these things that happened in the 80s and the 90s to this latchkey generation, the generation right before it, where things were a little loosey-goosey there for a minute. And yeah, that had its pros, but its cons were fatal. And I'm not willing to handle anything where the cons to it could be fatal. So I am just going to say a little thank you, blessing, gratefulness for all of the ways that we have lived and learned from these terrible, terrible things. But what a case. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And if you guys liked what you heard and you've liked what you've heard in the past and you want to keep listening, I mean, I'm biased, but I definitely think you should leave us a 5-star review. Again, absolutely. Biased, but I do also think I'm right.
If you want to see a pedo version of Jeffrey Dahmer, you are more than welcome to do that on our Instagram.
A more pedo version of Jeffrey Dahmer? I mean, come on.
Well, okay, you're right. I mean, but it's bad.
It's not. I mean, he's good. Sometimes you can look at a mugshot and you can know what somebody did, and other times it catches you off guard what they did. And when you guys look at this guy, you tell me. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, you know, I am curious.
He does have Dahmer's glasses, though. I think he stole them.
It's that, and it's like the hairline, I think. But anyway, all of that to say.
Yeah, they did no favors with that hair. That comb over, please. Yeah. And that hunchback, forget about it. Anyway.
Forget about it.
All of that to say, I know that was a rough one. If you made it through it, thank you. We appreciate it. Yeah. And we hope you learned something. And if you're thinking about it, we want to know what you're thinking. What are your thoughts? Because my head's kind of spinning. I didn't research all of this and come to like, yes, I found all of the answers and I want to share them all with you now. Yes. Yeah. Like I do not claim to hold all the answers. We never do. I want to know what you guys think. We all come from different experiences and live life in different ways. So I'd love to know what your thoughts are. So
let us know.
And you can do that over on our Instagram page, or you can send us an email. It's all linked below.
It is. If you did want to, again, see Megan, see Creepy Dahmer wannabe, any of the people, the places, the things that we talk about in any episode, you can always do that on our Instagram at About Time for True Crime Pod, with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period TIME period FOR period TRUE period CRIME period POD, because podcast was too long. But if you, much like Instagram, want to say something a little bit longer, you want to send us a pod pet, you want to let us know how your day is going, what you thought about this case, any lists that you want to come up with, you can do that to our email. But Allie, where would they email that?
So if you wanted to send us an email, you could do that to abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's abouttime4tc@gmail.com. Thank you. We love you. We love to hang out with you. And if I do look at my clock, that was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye.
Ugh.
I know.
I'm gonna call my therapist.
I know.